Hello and welcome everyone to a mystical journey to the Sacred Site Global Summit, where we will journey to beautiful sacred sites with healers, shamans, scientists, doctors, wisdom keepers, and coaches to gain wisdom and healing to self, the collective, and our divine Mother Earth. During the course of this event, you will learn that a sacred site is not only an external place or structure, but also our own body. You may have heard of the term, your body is a temple. Therefore, we will also journey inward to access our internal sacred site, for example, our sacred heart. You will hear experts talk about their own healing journeys and the work they're doing to raise awareness and consciousness of individuals, the collective, as well as raising the vibrations of our great spiritual mother, Gaia, to create more joy, peace, and abundance for all sentient beings on our beautiful and divine planet, our home. I'm your host and the creator of this event, Ami Sohi. And before we begin, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Jocelyn Starfeather for her tremendous mentorship and guidance during the creation of this summit, without whom I would not be able to present today. I'm also very grateful to all my family and friends for their unconditional love and support throughout my journey. And last but not least, I'm very grateful to all of you for taking the time and having the courage to be here today. So thank you. So without further ado, I'm very excited and thrilled to present Veronica Goodchild. Dr. Veronica Goodchild is Emerita Professor of the Pacifica Graduate Institute, Jungian a psychotherapist, pilgrimage leader, and author. She moved from her native England to the US in her early 20s and completed her graduate education in New York and California, spending most of her adult life there. She has been drawn to sacred sites since her late teens when she visited Israel and had some mystical experiences. Over the years, following her interests and promptings from dreams, she has visited the ancient sites of Greece, the sacred valley around Cusco in Peru, the goddess temples of Malta, and the ancient sites of Egypt, France, and England. A dream in 2016 led her to creating some of her own pilgrimages, the Magdalena Mysteries in southwest France, the Bee Priestess Oracle tradition in Creta and mainland Greece, and the sacred landscape of Great Britain, where many crop circles appear each year. Veronica is the author of Songlines of the Soul, Pathways Towards a New Vision for a New Century, and Eros and Chaos, The Sacred Mysteries and Dark Shadows of Love. Veronica lives in southwest France, and her topic for today is Treasure and Transformation in the Ritual of Pilgrimage. Hello and welcome, Veronica, to this beautiful summit and this sacred space. It's a privilege and honor to have you here with us today. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm delighted to be here. And like you, I want to acknowledge all the people that are listening in today. But thank you so much for organizing this summit because it's one of my favorite topics. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have you here with us, Veronica. So, Veronica, how did you discover pilgrimage and the joy of visiting sacred sites?
Okay, well, back in 2013, when my husband and I were still teaching at Pacifica in California, we took some extra time out and we went to France. And we ended up I'd always wanted to look at the Dordogne caves, the ancient, caves and the art in the caves. But then we after that, which was amazing. But after that, we moved on to Aix-en-Provence. And I was at that time sort of wondering what to do with my life. Was it time to change, make a change of some kind? And I think partly this was because I was getting increasingly concerned about the environmental crises and the fact that endless wars seem to just, never end on our planet. And this led me to think, because these are sort of collective problems and they're so huge and they can be so overwhelming for people. So it led me to think, how could one contribute in a small but practical and meaningful way to, particularly at that time, the environmental crisis? And then I had a dream. And in the dream was very long, but I'll tell you the bit that matters for this part. Several snakes approach me, and one of them wraps itself around my right arm, and I'm quite afraid, and I try to pry it off, and as I attempt to pry it off, it tightens its grip even more, and my efforts are useless. And then the snake speaks to me telepathically, and it says, "I'm much more powerful than you. You need to submit to this fact. Your ego self must submit to the power of the snake, because the snake is the energy of life itself, and that is more powerful than you. It is useless to fight this reality," it's saying. Trying to fend me off is merely an expression of your fear." And it sort of concluded by saying something like, "Put your lesser self in service to what is more powerful. That is in service to life itself. That is the true reality." So I don't fully understand this mysterious communication, which is coming in just purely telepathically, but I try to follow its wisdom. So I try to relax and to accept what it's telling me. And as I do this, the snake on my arm is sort of staring me in my face like this. And the space between us, though, opens up this sort of portal, this mysterious portal. And what I feel I'm glimpsing is the energy of space itself. In other words, it was like an underlying reality, not available to our ordinary state of consciousness. Perhaps it's what the physicists call the zero-point field or the quantum plenum. I have no idea, but it's just, I marvel at it, as if I'm marveling at the essence of the mystery of life itself. And I feel very humbled by this vision, but also very in awe of it. And the effect of this dream was to make me realize on a sort of personal level that I needed to put aside my more intellectual side, which is very important to me as well, because it's I love all the research and all of that stuff, and that's why I enjoy teaching so much and writing. But as a Jungian psychotherapist, when you have a dream, you write it down and you write your associations to the dream down and all of this, and you move from that towards deeper and deeper levels of dream work. But I felt in this instance that doing all of that was great, but it just wasn't adequate. And I thought, okay, I can do all of that, but what I need to do is I need to get out on the earth, and I need to walk. I need to put my books aside and I need to walk, because snakes, they have such a huge mythology, but they, among many, many other things, they signal the spiritual wisdom of the body and the power of the instincts, to Kundalini energy and serpent wisdom. And they're connected to the goddess, and they're personified by black Madonnas. And they point to sort of, oracular knowing, not knowing with the mind and the head, but knowing from the deepest instincts, because you know that you know that's true, and it bypasses, you know, that level. And so this was yeah, this dream was obviously very powerful, and it did, but it had this result of pushing me out seriously into walking. And at that time, we were living just at the foot of Mont Saint-Victoire outside Aix-en-Provence. Literally, we happened to be in a rental right at the foot of it. So every day I got up, and for about 2 months, I simply just walked on this mountain every day, discovering different paths. And I did it in a particular way. It wasn't just like going for a walk. It was, I felt that, you know, with my concerns about the earth, I thought, actually, I've got to listen to the earth. I've got to listen to what the earth is saying about these problems. Not just all the science, which I know is important, but it makes you so terrified. It just freezes you, you know, when you read it. And it's, I hate to say this, but it is also one perspective. And my dream was leading me, though, in a very different direction. And so for 2 months, I walked, trying to be as aware as I possibly could of the of my environment. And I realized that doing this really awakened me to the presence of the spirit of nature itself, perhaps a bit like what the snake was trying to show me in the vision. I don't know. I've only just thought of that just now. I've never made that connection before. But this happened particularly at the end, because actually this 2 month walk pushed me onto my first, you know, pilgrimage path. But what happened at the end was that I found that I was really sad to leave the mountain. And then that made me realize, oh my God, I have actually made a connection with this mountain. I've made a connection to the spirit of this mountain, not as a rock, but as a spirit. And I was so sad to leave it. And I remember it was a really hot September day, and everything was incredibly still. And so I decided, in a kind of ritual way, just spontaneously, I'm going to just express my feelings to the mountain, which I did. And I just said, thank you for accompanying me. I'm sorry to leave you. This has been really important to me. You've helped me decide to go on this pilgrimage route. And I was thanking it. And suddenly this huge wind came up. It just out of nowhere, and it just as if encircled us. It was just, and it was so shocking in the sense of unexpected and awesome. And I knew in my heart that I had been heard and I had been responded to. So that was huge for me, that felt sense of the soul of the earth. As I say, you know, that I think is the serpent wisdom, the knowing from some other place than our rational minds. So so that's how I decided to walk the pilgrimage path, one of the four main paths in France, which joins the Compostela de Santiago in Spain. But it's also called, you know, the Camino in France, and that was the pilgrimage route that I went on my first one, which started, as I say, at Le Puy-en-Velay in the Haute-Loire, and I'll come back to that. So this was the sort of conscious decision to do pilgrimage, but it really began in a less conscious way, and that's the Israel experience that I that you mentioned. When I was 18 and finished my A-levels at grammar school in England, my parents said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go to Israel. And it was sort of like, I'm not quite sure quite where that came from. But anyway, they said, okay. So I went to work on a kibbutz, ended up in Northern Galilee. But We worked in the morning because of the heat, picking apples. But in the afternoon, a friend that I made there, another English girl, and I would go hitchhiking, and we'd go to all the sacred sites that we could go to that you hear about in the Bible and all of this. And so that two major experiences happened when I was there. One, when I was at the Sea of Tiberias. And I can only describe it as suddenly slipping into another place where I experienced the world as a kind of thin veil through which a kind of invisible light came through from another world behind it. It was almost as if it was literally the world, the solid world that we know in everyday experience, which was actually like a floating curtain. And this other reality was constantly coming through into it. And that I don't know if that was, it wasn't the first mystical, conscious mystical experience I had, but it was very impactful, very, very profound. It made me very still, as if I'd kind of been absorbed into it in some way, if I can say that. And then the second thing that happened on that journey was that we went to the Dead Sea and we were swimming in the Dead Sea. Well, you can't swim in the Dead Sea, it's too salty, but you can lie on your back and you can float. And I was floating in the Dead Sea and looking up, and I saw all these caves and everything. And I knew in the cells of my body that I'd lived there. I knew I had lived there. And that story unfolds itself throughout my life to the present day. That was the place that was came to be known as Qumran. Well, it was called Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls came from, and and where the Essene communities, the early true Christian communities, lived. So those two experiences and that journey changed what I wanted to read at university. I was going to read law, and I changed to theology. Now, of course, the theology at university is nothing to do with mystical experiences, which I thought, well, of course it would be. And I can remember saying, why aren't we studying the mystics? And they just all looked at me as if I had two heads, which is amazing. It probably doesn't happen now, but back in 1969, it did. So that didn't work for me. So I didn't finish that, and I went back to university in New York, actually, at Columbia later. That was the less conscious, but when I was preparing for this, I realized that in fact was my first experience of pilgrimage. And the kinds of experiences you can have on pilgrimage and why they're so valuable. They can change your life. They can change you. So,
Wow, that is, yeah, absolutely amazing. Wow, what you experienced, yeah, in the mountains in Israel. Wow, and really listening to the spirit of the earth, right? To her soul, Mother Earth's soul. Yeah, wow, that's so, yeah, and then what you said about the world that we're living in, it's a thin veil. You saw it lifting. Yeah, I always see
It
it.
was,
See, Yeah, so that's
it's hard
wow,
to
that's
hold on to these
magical.
experiences sometimes and know that that is a reality somewhere. I know my desk is solid wood, but but it's not, we know from quantum physics it's not only solid wood. So we know more and more, even with physics, that everything is light. It just depends on your perspective. And that's so helpful because we do live in a multidimensional world. And to know that depending on which dimension you're in, on whatever, there is another knowledge that comes through. That's amazing. That's what we're reconnecting with today.
Yeah, absolutely. We're reconnecting to the power of who we really are, finding out who we truly are,
Absolutely.
multi-dimensional beings, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow, that was your experience in Israel, like a treasure opened up for you. So what are some of the other treasures of pilgrimage and visiting sacred sites?
Well, to give a very specific example, let me tell you one thing that happened on, amongst many things that happened on the Lepuy route that I walked. The first one I only walked for 12 days solo. I did it as a meditation for the earth. I didn't want to be disturbed in my meditation walking by being with anybody else because I knew I'd get distracted and just stay in my head too much. The second one I did was in 20, 2 years later in 2015. I did a month like that, a solo walk from where I ended up, Le Puy de Conques, which is an old medieval village, a sacred village, sacred site, amazing cathedral in there. And then the second part was Conques to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, which is where the last village in France before you walk over the mountains into and do the Compostela across. Well, you can go across northern Spain along the coast, or you can just go the sort of more conventional route to the end, which is not necessarily Santiago. It's actually Finisterre, which is on the coast. But anyway, I haven't done that one, but I hope to soon. Yeah. Anyway, so just to give one example on the Le Puy route, the first one I did. So it was, I don't know why I remember this, but it was the autumn equinox. And I was musing about what the equinox is, how we're leaving summer behind and going into the kind of sleeping, dreaming time of autumn and winter. And, which is symbolically about letting go. It's about, death, renewal in the spring. What are you going to keep from what you've gathered sort of in the summer and put into the dreaming and then see what new shoots? That's sort of on from a Celtic or indigenous path that the equinox represents. And so I'm kind of thinking about that, and then I'm walking along, and then on the path I see this very big stone, and I think, oh wow, it just stopped me in my tracks like that. And it looked a bit like a sort of cone-headed figure or something like that. But anyway, it struck me as being very powerful, so I stopped. And it felt like this is a guardian on the path here, And so I rested against him, and then I asked for his guidance on the way. And then it was as if he started to communicate with me. And so what he did was he said, "You need to focus, you meaning not just me, but sort of humans, on the things that last." That was his sort of communication. He said, "Like me, I've been here for thousands of years, and that we need to really now focus on enduring values and what the earth needs now, like compassion and generosity and wisdom and devotion to the whole of life." Saying that it wasn't only about our planet, but these things exist on other planets, and we are part of a greater whole. So in what we do on Earth really affects what happens on other planets and in other star systems, because we all belong together. And that we should see life through the eyes of eternity, not just what's pragmatic and expedient for us now, which is sort of how we live. Even, everything is built to wear out in 3 years, including cars and computers and God knows what. There's this sort of built-in obsolescence, as if we don't value material things as lasting somehow. And then, because I know a bit about alchemy, and he sort of said that, or he didn't say, I thought, It's like he's talking about the philosopher's stone in alchemy too. So not just the physical rock, but also, the philosopher's stone was the goal of the work because it was an image of something that endures. And so through your own efforts in life to live your true destiny, as it were, how the soul is calling you, and through the conflicts and the breakdowns and the suffering that often goes along with that, inevitably goes along with it, as well as the joys, that you're creating something in yourself that endures. Some call it the subtle body, some call it the resurrection body. The subtle body was also, what the philosopher's stone referred to. And so so that was more like an association that I made with the rock. But, philosophy is really the love of wisdom. So it's the stone of wisdom. It's what we cultivate as we mature, as we meet the challenges of our life. But also, I noticed suddenly that at the base of this rock, there was a bee's nest. And so I noticed the bees, and then he started talking to me about the bees. And he talked about the bees as how incredibly valuable they are to the planet because they, oh my goodness, they are responsible for so much, a third of our food supply, or even more, I think. And he talked about, how they work together, but they work for the whole. They work in service to, the queen bee. But each bee has its own job. And, that we need to think more in terms of community, and not just ourselves, but how what we do affects communities, then how it affects the planet, then how it affects the galaxy and the broader, the broader universe. So from that, me being me, I did quite a lot of research when I got home about bees, not just how bees operate, but also mythically. Bees are the priestesses of Demeter. That's partly why we went to Crete on one of my journeys to really honor the bee tradition, the priestess bee tradition. And of course, probably many people know that the oracular center at Delphi, the Pythia, was also called the Delphic Bee. And you think about honey, you think about how honey is used, used to be used for embalming, for example. It was transformed into mead, into an intoxicant for sacred rituals. No doubt part of, the ecstatic rites, maybe even of the Demeter Persephone mysteries in Greece. And then you think about how we get wax from them and how we light a candle, and how we light a candle because beeswax, pure beeswax, clears the atmosphere. But we also pray or create sacred space out of, burning a candle. But then I also came across a book, The Shamanic Way of the Bee, which fascinated me. And that led me to a place called the Path of Pollen, which is part of the Sacred Trust in England. And the Path of Pollen is an ancient European indigenous shamanic path. And there's a course that they do called the Way of the Melissai, which I ended up doing. It was fascinating because it's an ancient feminine oracular tradition that comes from Eastern Europe, and I'm sure was active and known about in Crete and other parts of Greece and elsewhere. But it's a tradition that engages, you know, transformation, and divination is taught, and there's a humming mantra that you do to enter into a slightly different state of consciousness to access the oracular wisdom. So it was an extraordinary experience, and so and also Rudolf Steiner's essays on bees, which are fascinating. But as you can see, if you engage the imagination as you're walking along, or just notice how your imagination is being activated, what you learn, and then what you learn by speaking to the denizens of nature, rocks, birds, whatever crossed my path, rivers, and listen into the sounds and the smells and the atmospheres of forests. As I walked through forests, it was absolutely beautiful route, by the way, Le Puy de Conques. Oh, stunningly beautiful. Up mountains, down valleys, amazing. But if you have the intention, I guess I want to say, to on a pilgrimage, to open to what wants to present itself to you, just in your consciousness, if you do it, things happen, synchronicities happen, magical things happen and teach you. And sometimes those things can, when you get home, lead you into either further research or something can change your life, both inwardly, but also perhaps in terms of what you do in your life, not necessarily changing your job, but what you bring to your job, maybe something like that. So there are many, many extraordinary gifts that come with making yourself available, stepping outside the ordinary world to make yourself available for a transformative experience that I would suggest before you even, not just for yourself, but for others too, because that's the world we live in. We need to be thinking about, you know, how what we do affects the whole, as I said before. So again, it was an experience of feeling that soul of nature deeply, feeling nature was completely alive, filled with spirit, soul. And I think one of the main things was feeling that my heart was opening. I felt like my heart was opening. It helped me open my heart more. And I was profoundly grateful for that. And I realized how healing nature can be when we really make a relationship with her, which we can do, of course, at any time. But there is a certain ritual that goes along with pilgrimage that does open magical doors. And I'll say a bit more, perhaps a bit later, about how I came to discover the four stages of pilgrimage. And the other thing, the main message for me on this journey, particular journey, was that the earth said to me, basically, I do not want to be fretted over only. I want to be loved. And that changed my whole feeling, well, not my entire feeling about the climate crisis, because I know all the things, but we also need to consciously establish a relationship with the earth, not just the earth in general, but make an effort to establish a relationship with the earth and love her, because she is our mother. She provides and loves us. And listen, the planet's going to survive. The earth's going to survive. That's not the problem. It's kind of like the virus called humans that need to change. So, So these are profound, inner, heartfelt, soulful things that we can learn on pilgrimage, on the ritual of pilgrimage. I have other examples that I can give.
Yes, please. I mean, yeah, what you're sharing, it's so powerful. Wow.
You know, it's just my experiences. So in 2016, we had in fact decided to let our day jobs go. And I had created a very open space because I thought, okay, what have I just done? Number one. And number two was, okay, how am I going to recreate myself? Now that I don't even use the word retirement, it's so ridiculous. Now that I've left my day job, which was wonderful for almost 20 years teaching and everything, I loved it. But now, what am I going to do? I actually had no idea. So it was a bit terrifying. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be open. So we went to Italy for a month. And then I said, okay, let's, on the way home, let's just go in, because I love France. I've always loved France. I came here a lot when I was a child. And I said, let's just go into the southwest of France, because I've never been there. I don't know anything about it. Let's go there just to see. And we were sort of thinking at that time, shall we move to France? Shall we? Ooh, I don't know. We were betwixt and between. So I said, let's just. So we took a bus from Perugia, where we'd been staying. And I said, let's get a bus, because then we can see the beautiful landscape all the way up. So the bus we got to on the first day, we had to stop at Genoa overnight. So that night, the night of the day before, the night before the day where we were going into the Languedoc, I had this vision. And the vision was, it was a dream vision. I was fast asleep. But it was so numinous, so powerful. It was like a dream vision. And it was of a grail chalice coming up out of the ocean. For those of you who may or may not know about the grail legends, but the grail legends burst onto the European scene in the 12th century. And there's a lot that can be said there, but I don't want to get distracted. And it's really about the path that there are all these different stories that came on. And it was a kind of symbolic tale about the journey of the soul. It's a beautiful story. So the grail symbolically has been known as a chalice, the chalice of the Holy Grail. I mean, perhaps Monty Python people know, you know, at least something about the Holy Grail. Many people have heard of it, even if they don't know much about it. Anyway, I did know something about the Grail, because I taught a class on it at Pacifica, the myth of the Grail. And so here is this Grail chalice arising out of the ocean, and it's drawing up ocean water, and it's pouring out ocean water at the top, like a fountain, like that. And that was the dream. Well, it knocked me sideways, and it absolutely threw me out of sleep. But I didn't really know what it was about. You know, I wasn't quite sure why I was sort of having that dream. Didn't have any, you know, particular thoughts about it, but it was an experience. It was profoundly and majorly an experience. So what happened was that the next day we go into the Languedoc, and gradually during our stay there, I learned about all the traditions of Mary Magdalene, her associations with the Grail, and all the kind of sacred sites that, or, you know, that are associated with her, either in historical fact, which I have found out since, and also in legend and all of this, because it all gets mixed in together. And so while I was there, I visited, some of the sacred sites associated with Mary Magdalene, who, as we now know, after the crucifixion, went to Egypt, had her third child, her first child there, Sarah, and then left Egypt with an entourage of other women and other disciples, and ended up in the south of France, and then lived there for the rest of her life. And teaching and traveling in Provence and down into the Languedoc area, which is the southwest corner that kind of goes around towards Spain, that is called the Forgotten Corner because no one has ever been here. but it's an amazing place historically because it's the place of the Cathars, you know, the troubadours, the Knights Templar and their castle. That historically it's very, very important. From particularly the 11th to the 13th centuries. And the Cathars lived there, who were a kind of Gnostic Christian group who followed Mary Magdalene and Jesus, and who had nothing to do with the church because they thought the church was corrupt and about power and wealth and all of those things. And so that's a whole other story. But so I went to many of the sacred sites there. And when I got home, I went into a kind of meditation because I thought, I still don't quite know what this dream, how this dream of the Grail Chalice is connected to my life specifically at the moment. And so I went into a kind of meditation, I do a kind of meditation. It's like a shamanic journey type of thing. I sank down into it. And I said, can you help me understand how I need to relate to this dream vision? And Mary Magdalene appeared like just like that. And she said one phrase to me. She said, follow the path of the blue rose. Follow the path of the blue rose. And then she went. And so then I thought, what's that? And that's a whole other story. But all to say, that event and that first meditation that I did and subsequent ones that I did set up these kind of dialogues with her. And out of those dialogues, several things happened. One of them was, at one point she said, now you're learning all this about, you know, basically the authentic stories about my life and the life of Jesus and that whole story. And she said, so you might want to share this knowledge with others. And I thought, oh, well, how can I do that? And she said, I don't know, make it up. So that's how I started my own pilgrimages. I decided I would do pilgrimages for other people. And how that worked for my life was that it could link my Jungian mythic background, all of that, with sacred site visiting and being on the earth. So it brought all my interests together in one place. So again, that's how going to sacred sites, whether you're on an official journey or not, can lead to a change in your life. And then there's some experiences in Egypt as well, which are pretty important. But I don't know if that's enough, perhaps.
Yeah, wow. Very powerful shares. Thank you. Thank you, Veronica. Wow. And the path of the blue rose, right? That's the message you got from Mary Magdalena.
Yeah.
What is that? Did, Did you discover what that is
Oh,
exactly?
well, at the time, this was 2016, I looked it up online. There were one or two entries. I'd never heard of it. There were one or two entries that I didn't resonate with at all. But someone a bit later told me that the early Essenes, who were the early Christians that actually lived and grew up around Jesus and his family, who actually taught what Jesus, even in the canonical text, speaks about what Christianity is about, which is about caring for the downtrodden, opening the heart. It's all about love, really, as we know. Of course, it's not been about that in the history of the church at all. It's been quite the opposite. In fact, the Cathars were obliterated by the Roman Church in a genocide. I mean, it's horrendous what's gone on under the name of Christianity, as we know. They told me that they had heard that the blue rose was Mary Magdalene's path, because she was, according to the Gnostic texts, the Nag Hammadi library, so much so far, so as we know, the Gnostic Christian texts found in Egypt in the mid 1940s gave a very different picture of Christianity. It was more Gnostic. It was more about a path of illumination. It was not about any orthodoxy. It was about you find your own path by doing your own transformative work. And there are, rituals and initiations that go along with that. They said that the teachings of Mary Magdalene specifically were called the Path of the Blue Rose. I had no idea about that. And so I thought, okay, so what's my relationship? So I kept asking. I said, what's how do I do this Path of the Blue Rose? And it was basically, the communication was basically, it's like the serpent wisdom. Follow the crumbs in the forest. Follow your own intuitive way, using your dreams, your walking, your research, your whatever you know what your interests are. Use all of it, and it will come to you. It will just formulate itself. And that's what I mean about that early experience at the Dead Sea and the Qumran and knowing I lived there, and today still following, as it were, not some prescribed path at all, but following the path that is disclosing itself to me. And I get hints and messages along the way, such that, for example, one of my interests became, out of all my researches, was to follow the story to Egypt. And I was just in Egypt again in March, and for the third time. And so I'll just share this experience. But towards the end, it was about 2 days before the end of this sacred sites. Again, we were going to the temples. It's an amazing, if anybody is drawn to Egypt and has the opportunity to do a pilgrimage there, this was with Jocelyn, your mentor that you mentioned at the beginning, and Patricia Aiwan. It was just a stunning journey to the major temples along the Nile. I mean, that it's a cosmos in stone. It's why I think people are flocking there at the moment, because we're hungry for these sorts of experiences to connect to the Egypt is about the source. It's like it's about going to this, in some sense, the source of civilization, but it's also the source inside ourselves. And so it takes us to our own depths, because they left this extraordinary knowledge written in hieroglyphs and in temple structures and in pyramids, and it's just it's extraordinary the knowledge that they had. And so if anyone is drawn to doing that, they definitely they should. It'll change your life. It will. And towards the end, just to give an example of what another example of what happened, and then I'll say more generally what some of the treasures are of pilgrimage and sacred sites visits are. But I was wait, we were going to this oil, this, you know, Egyptian oils are quite famous. They're often the basis of all the major houses in, you know, Paris, and basis of all their perfumes and things. But and I knew from another journey about the sacred oils of Egypt and what they're used for. So we were about to go to one of these oil producers, and that we were getting off the bus, and I was just standing there waiting for other people to assemble, getting off the bus, and I look down and I see in the gutter a tiny chalice. I have it here, I'll show it to you.
Oh, wow.
This tiny chalice, and I saw it
Wow.
in the gutter. Tiny, as you can see. And I was absolutely amazed. As you can imagine, it was just there. And so I picked it up. And, you know, I looked around. I thought, oh, somebody dropped this. I said, is it a child's, or is it just someone's chalice they carry around in their bag? So I'm standing there, kind of, you know, holding. I didn't know what to do. And then I thought, okay, I guess it's mine. So it's got roses on it, and it's got, I don't know if you can see, it's got roses on it, and it's got
Yeah.
hearts. Can you see
Wow. Yeah.
roses and
Beautiful. That is, yeah.
hearts? Just so
Amazing.
charming. And it's not perfect, it's a bit battered, which is probably not a bad thing. We do get battered on, you know, the journey through life. And so that day, so we went to the oils. Mary Magdalene is known as a mirophore. A mirophore is a priestess of the sacred oils. That's why she could anoint Jesus with the spikenard and wipe his feet with her hair with the expensive oils. And that was because, that has a long story, but it's because as a wife, as a consort, it was her privilege and obligation to, it's like this happened in Egypt too, in ancient times, where the wife was really the, she carried the power that the pharaoh expressed. And it's similar. It's hard to say these things because I can't say more about it in this context. I don't want to give the wrong impression, but it's a powerful story, these other stories of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And of course the chalice was connected with the Last Supper as well, and the legends of it being carried to by Joseph of Arimathea to Glastonbury. So there's lots of lore, L-O-R-E, about the Grail Chalice. But that day in Egypt, we went after the oils to a Coptic church, and there were paintings of Mary Magdalene leaning her head on Jesus' shoulder at the Last Supper. I think there were three of them. I took photographs of them. And then there was a crypt in this Coptic church. That so she was one of the major disciples, clearly, according to these paintings and according to other stories. But in the chal in the crypt of this Coptic church, there was a sanctuary to Mary Magdalene, and there was an icon of her, and underneath was a Grail chalice. And so that all happened on one day. So then I thought, okay, here is the chalice again. How is this journey that I just took to Egypt connected in a way that I haven't discovered yet with the Grail and the Grail chalice and all that that represents? And so that's my next kind of unfolding. And this was the little gift, well, huge gift that I got on the way to say, okay, now what you gonna do, you know, now you have to move this forward kind of thing. So, yeah. So this is, again, these are the synchronicities. These are the magical things. These are the gifts, the learning that we can get when we undertake these journeys. And everybody, I would say, on this journey, and when I've done pilgrimages, always, because we set the intention at the beginning, what is the vision? What is the dream that I want to live and embody at this point in my life? And so setting the intention at the beginning of a journey can, like a ritual. And so when I do pilgrimages, we always have a ritual at the beginning. And we consciously, by moving our bodies one step forward, move into sacred space. And when you move into sacred space, you move into liminal space. And when you move into liminal space, you open the door for the guides and the spirits and what you need, what the gift is for you on this particular journey will come forward. And so pilgrimages are a bit like walking mystery schools, you know. That's how I experience them. And at the end, before we part on the last day, I always have everybody in a poem or a painting or telling an experience or a dream to sum up in not more than about 5 minutes, depending on the size, not more than about 5 minutes. What is the deepest treasure, the nugget of your experience on this journey? And that in itself, as a ritual of stepping, and then we step outside the sacred circle, but it's a way of completion, and it's a way of, as it were, focusing like a laser onto what was the key thing, and then that you learned, and then how are you going to take that home, and how are you going to live it in your life? How are you going to share it, and how are you going to live it? Because it's never just interesting experiences that are the thing. They are the thing, but they are the thing because they lead us somewhere. They want something from us. And it's our obligation to meet the gift received with what we can give back. And so that's what I meant about the four stages of pilgrimage. You have the call, where you feel absolutely called to go somewhere, even if you don't understand it. When we went around the room in this recent Egyptian, Jocelyn's tour and Patricia's tour, most of the people said, I have no idea why I'm here. I just know I have to be here. That is more often the case than knowing. Second of all, you make a conscious ritual entry into sacred space. That's the second thing you do. And I've described how, very briefly, how I do that. Then you are in liminal magical space. Then the third thing is, what happens along the way? What meditations, what dreams, what insights? So you have your journal, you record the events that really speak to you in a deep, in a soulful and heartfelt way. You record them. And then the final part is, for me, I make a ritual out of leaving sacred space, because you're going back into ordinary time. And when you've been in sacred space, ordinary time can seem very strange. as you probably are aware, everybody is aware. And then the injunction, the obligation, is to share it with the community somehow. It can be simple, but that concretizes it in a way that just leaving it floating about doesn't quite do. So you need to do something, and that can be anything. It's up to you. You can write, you can give a talk, you can paint a picture, you can sing a song, you can, it's endless what you can do, but that's the obligation at the end, to truly complete what you've given your time to, which from the outset was not just for you. It was for your community, and it was for the planet, and I would say the broader galaxy. These things are noticed by the energies of the Earth and galaxy. I'm absolutely convinced of that. So
absolutely. Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for your powerful shares. Yeah, I can just go on listening to you, Veronica, all day, the powerful stories you have for us. But I'm cautious of the time. And I know you also have a free gift for everyone, for the audience. Can you say a few words on that, please?
Yes, certainly. Well, first of all, I'd just like to encourage I hate to say it, but my website is quite out of date. But with COVID, I stopped doing, like a lot of people, I stopped doing many things. And only, I've been doing online talks really since then. But I'd like to encourage people to go to my website, because it does have articles that one or two of you or some of you might be interested in looking at. And I'm in the process now actually of assembling all my talks and that I've done since 21, 22 and this year. And just the PDF of them, not the slides, but just the PDF and of the full talk, because normally I do make a talk, but I don't. Sometimes I read the talk, but more and more now I don't. And so it gives you the full talk if you're interested. And then also what I'll do is I started a project, Walking the Songlines of the Soul, which is about pilgrimage. And it's not finished, but the first chapter is on my recent posts, even though it's not really that recent now when I started it, but the last couple of years. If you sign up for my website, I'll send you chapter two, which is done also. And so that's what I'll do.
Mm-hmm.
If that's okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Veronica, for being with us and sharing all your beautiful stories, all your sacred stories. So everyone, please, the link is provided below this interview. So click on the link and claim your free gift. Check out Veronica's website and you'll find loads of treasures in there, on her website. So please go and check out Veronica's website and all her papers and blogs that she's been writing and the new project she's working on. So once again, Veronica, thank you so much for your time and being with us today. Absolutely. It was such a pleasure and honor to have you with us.
Such a pleasure and honor for me also. And thank you so much for inviting me. I've enjoyed myself. And, you know, these talks always stimulate so much for me as well. And I learned just by preparing for them. So
yeah,
it's a great value as well. But I hope it means something to some of the people watching too.
Yes, I'm sure there's so many people on their awakening journey today. And so, yeah, so everyone, you know, if you're on your journey, the awakening, the ascension journey, yeah, ask your heart, you know, go within and go to these sacred sites to discover your gifts, discover your own treasures. Yeah. And you just don't know what miracles await you at these sites. So thank you so much. I mean,
Well, I just want to just quickly say how difficult and painful this transition is for so many people. And, you know, to keep steady with your awakening experiences, because you are so needed on the planet, you know, you change, the world changes, you know, so your efforts are recognized and they're important for you and beyond you. And keep going through the storm of life, because I know it can be very, very challenging. So anyway.
Beautiful words to end the conference. Thank you again, Veronica. And thank you everyone for attending today. And I wish you a lovely day. Thank you. Goodbye.